Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, we have Nora Jones and Casey Rosenthal, authors of Chaos Engineering, discussing key takeaways from the book and from their experience working on chaos projects. This episode builds upon the recent discussion they had on the Chaos Community Show. Created for developers, by developers, GoTo gathers the best minds in the software community. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in Chicago, Amsterdam, and Copenhagen, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Congratulations on being published, and it's nice to finally meet you in person, Nora.
Yeah, likewise. Nice to meet you in person, too.
So I know it's going to come up, so let's just get this question out of the way. Your name is Nora Jones. I'm sure you get asked this all the time about your name. Is there any relation to Indiana?
No relation to Indiana, no.
Told you, James. Okay, if I could take you back to the year MMXVII, November 30th, MGM Grand Arena in Vegas, the AWS reInvent conference. There were 40,000 people in the audience, another 60,000 people watching remotely, and you had the stage. You spoke about the journey of chaos engineering sophistication, the forces of chaos. How did you get to that stage? What was your journey to end up there?
Yeah, I was working at a company called Jet.com that had just launched in 2015. They were an e-commerce website, and their marketing team was doing a phenomenal job. But as with any good problem, you need to keep up with the tech, and so we were having a lot of incidents, right? We needed to meet the demand that was coming to the website. And, you know, we were meeting almost every morning to talk about the previous night's incident. So at that point, we had talked about just trying some new techniques. I came across Netflix's Chaos Monkey, and I started implementing a version of that at Jet.com. It went really interestingly. I thought I was making a tool, and slowly but surely, I realized it was a cultural shift, actually. And the tool was just kind of a catalyst for that. So at that point, I had stayed for a little while. I was leading developer productivity and developer tools there. And I went over to Netflix for a couple years after that, where I was on the chaos engineering team with Casey, although this is the first time we've met in person.
Interesting.
And then was building tooling there for a little while, and that's where I did the reInvent talk in 2017. But my journey's changed a lot since then. My thoughts have evolved a lot since then, even as well. But it's a pretty fascinating field, and I think it's going to keep evolving too.
You mentioned you worked on the chaos engineering team at Netflix, which I believe I managed. Was I the worst manager you've ever had?
No.
See, James?
I'm surprised by that.
So, yeah. I've heard of Jet, which you mentioned. James and I were talking about this last week. It was acquired by Walmart. Mm-hmm. And then discarded. Comforting to know that even Walmart sometimes regrets what it buys at Walmart. But I don't often use the word brilliant, except in self-affirmation. But in less than 5 years, you've gone from Jet to Netflix to Slack. Now you run a VC-backed startup. Is there, if you could be self-reflective for a moment, is there anything that you would attribute your success to, you know, versus other people who have had the same advantages? And, you know, obviously we live in a biased system towards privilege. But is there anything in particular about your outlook on software, your understanding of where the industry is, that you feel has contributed to your success?
I mean, I've been so lucky to work with amazing people at each company I've been at. I mean, Jet was kind of a startup environment. I was in hardware before Jet, still focused on reliability, but it was a different journey for me. And I was able to take some of the same theories and approaches towards hardware reliability. And I was actually surprised how much it applied towards software as well. And honestly, just collaborating and getting to know teammates. Like one of the things, so I studied computer engineering back when I went to school. And one of the things I really disliked about the major was how individual it was, you know, how I felt that it could be a lot more collaborative. I felt that we were going to build better things if we were working together, if we were talking. And I think sometimes the software industry falls into that trap as well, where you put your headphones on and you just code all day. And I think actually sitting down and working with my coworkers and building reliability tools and really thinking about the business impacts of things has just completely changed my viewpoint and, you know, has really helped me along this journey. I'm still going, but it's been so fun. It's really just the people.
And so that perspective of, in the language of the field, you know, viewing it more as the or at least being open to the socio part of the socio-technical system. Mm-hmm. How much of that was influenced? You're still in the master's program at Lund University?
Yeah, I am still in it.
I believe. how much of that has changed your thinking?
It changed my world. I mean, like it was stuff that I knew and felt. And then I came into that first week of class and I felt like I could actually put theories and research and practical applications behind stuff I was thinking and feeling all along. And I just feel like the software industry has so much ahead of it in terms of reliability, in terms of how we think about making the internet, you know, a place folks can trust from a reliability perspective and totally understand the impacts of what we're building as software engineers, not only to society, but to our businesses.
You mentioned collaboration earlier, and you launched a community, Learning from Incidents, which now has a website, learningfromincidents.io, some very well-recognized names in the industry, submit blogs there and post articles and essays. How did that come about? Was that an extension of this this work from Lund and your interest in socio-technical systems?
Yeah, absolutely. So working at Netflix was so amazing on the chaos engineering team, but it was a very different chaos engineering perspective than I had at Jet, right? Most folks at Jet hadn't heard of Chaos Monkey or chaos engineering or the philosophies behind it. And we were a startup, right? We were just getting off the ground, whereas Netflix formalized it. And so I was coming into a team that had started building tooling around that. But, you know, as you know, Casey, most of the folks using that tooling were folks on our team. And I started trying to think about, like, how to get more folks in the organization using it, how to extract their mental models. And so being in the Lund program helped me ask those questions a little bit better so that we could get more people at the table and understand the actual business impacts, refine folks' mental models, and help make the system more reliable overall so that we understand how we're actually working. And so I think shortly after, you know, a month or two at the Lund program, I started looking into incidents at Netflix a little bit more. And I would just review previous incidents. Lauren Hochstein was doing a great job at that at Netflix too. And I started getting into it as well, like reading previous Slack transcripts, looking at pages that went off, looking at who needed to be paged, looking at what dates we were getting paged, looking at what events were happening around that time. But I started doing that as, okay, maybe we can build something to feed into our chaos tooling to like prioritize experiments based on previous incidents that had happened or previous surprises that had happened or prioritized certain teams that were maybe underwater in certain regards, like around different dates. And so that was why I started looking into incidents there. I ended up doing like a cross incident analysis of a bunch of different incidents just to see which themes kind of emerged from the organization. And it was so amazing to do. It took a significant amount of time, but it was so enlightening to see which people were involved, which teams were involved, which people weren't on call, all these different things. And then bubbling up and sharing that with the rest of the organization helped them prioritize their OKRs, helped them prioritize feature requests against reliability measures. And at that point, I was like, this is a lot of work. I feel like there's probably more people in the industry doing stuff like this. I'm just going to send out a tweet and see who else is doing stuff like this, because I want to talk to them. I feel like it's going to be more beneficial for us all as an industry if we're talking about some of the stuff we're finding, because then we can all improve together. So I sent out a tweet about starting a learning from incidents community. And I think I got about 200 DMs that night of folks wanting to join. I wanted to keep the community small just to make sure that we were, you know, getting to know each other, because we were sharing, you know, specific things about our companies and our incidents. And so I wanted it to be a tight-knit community. And then we ended up learning a bunch together. And so I wanted to open source those learnings further, which is why I started the learningfromincidents.io website. And we've been so lucky to have a number of great folks write blog posts on there about their chop wood and carry water stories at their companies on how they're doing this. And it's, you know, I think a lot of folks see the word learning and they're like, okay, well, you have to do more than learn. You have to fix, but it's, you can't fix until you're learning how the thing happened to begin with. And so I think that's one of the things I'm trying to help folks understand as well, too.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
And it feels like you're on the precipice if you haven't already opened up an entire new discipline, right? It's blue skies ahead. Where does that community go next?
Yeah, it's a great question. I see that community evolving into a number of different things. I would like folks are sharing some of their post incident reviews in there. And they're getting feedback from folks that are not at their companies. I started my own company around the incident space too, and we're not ready to share stuff yet, but we will be willing to soon. We will be able to soon. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to share some of the post-incident world there as well.
Maybe I can inject here. Nora, this has been something that I've been kind of thinking about and wondering about. Maybe you could kind of speak to this. It's like we have Netflix is kind of this place that has really been a launching pad for a lot of interesting startups, and we see that over the years, like both Casey and Nora, yourself, like both of y'all have startups coming out of this field. What made Netflix particularly successful in being able to help people see their vision, being able to kind of tackle these problems and then spread this to the wider audience?
Casey, do you want to take that first?
No, I don't recall being there.
That's, you know, I think you said earlier you had recalled being there. Netflix was an amazing place to work in a lot of different ways. They really share freedom and responsibility. And so you can work on what you want to work on, but you have to be able to back it up. You have to be able to own it. You have to be able to share it. One of the things that was really great for me at Netflix, although sometimes it could be a lot, was folks in the reliability organization had to play every single role. I had to be a product manager. I had to be a designer. I had to be a back-end engineer. I had to be a front-end engineer. I had to be an internal evangelist. And I got good at a bunch of those different skill sets just by being there. And I think it was part of the Netflix culture that, that really helped with that. But a lot of those skill sets helped me find my way into starting my own company as well. And so I'm so grateful for that experience.
At best, I think those companies, at best, have a generative culture where there's very little bureaucracy. But of course, aligning an entire company to those kinds of principles is not always easy.
Yeah.
Just as an outsider looking in at Netflix, Blockbuster 2.0, how did it become the place that generated all this? Like, you wouldn't have suspected that if you were to write this down in like in a book, you wouldn't have thought, oh, that's the place where innovation is going to come from. And in both of your books, Chaos Engineering, it had that, a lot of those pieces, but I think that's kind of hearing you talk about that is really helpful.
In the book, you talk about using a facilitator to investigate an incident, much like is done in other high stakes industries, medicine, aviation, and maritime. Can you explain how that relates to chaos engineering and some of your work in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So, at Netflix, we had built a really great system and we could do a lot of things. Like, we could inject failure safely in production. But we had this like giant form for folks to fill out if they wanted to do it. And it was a pretty daunting form. And it's not like folks were thinking about doing chaos experiments on all the time, unless they were the four of us on this team. We were thinking about it all the time. They were thinking about it maybe once every few months. And so seeing a giant form asking what business metric you want to impact can be kind of scary for folks, apparently. And so doing some facilitation techniques at Netflix was really helpful, like talking to teams and asking what kept them up at night. And if you actually had time, talking to folks individually and seeing how mental models differ between folks on the same team, seeing how mental models differ between different tenures on the same team, different roles on the same team, different pieces of the system on the same team. Like, a really good facilitator can extract that out of folks and find those gaps. So when I went to Slack, we had been rolling out Envoy, and folks wanted to do some chaos experiments on it. And so I started asking the questions I had put in the chaos book, right? And I really grouped with people on the team. We filled out a lot of pre-work to be able to run the chaos experiment. And by the time we got about 75% through facilitating the experiment and preparing for it, we realized we weren't actually ready to roll it out. And we didn't even need to run the chaos experiment to know that. It was just asking those questions.
You said a really good facilitator can pull those things out. How does one become a really good facilitator?
It's a good question. It's not being the expert, but being able to dig into things in different words that someone tells you about a situation. So if they're saying, yeah, this part of the system is very flaky, not being like, oh yeah, I know that tipped over last night, even though you do know, asking them, oh, what do you mean it's flaky? Can you elaborate on what that word means? And I know that can be kind of awkward, especially with folks that you've worked with for 3 years. I remember in a post-incident review once, I was asking someone what tool they used to make a configuration change. And they were like, Nora, I made a change with you in this system like a couple weeks ago. Like, they were just looking at me. I'm like, well, humor me for a second. And I think being a good facilitator is all about being able to kind of remove that ego and ask some of the silly questions that you might know the answers to, but it's really not about the canonical answer, right? It's about how someone else views the system, because then you can see the gaps between how they view the system, maybe how you view the system, maybe how other people in the organization are viewing that system. And you get to see how you actually work versus how you think you work as an organization. It kind of bubbles things up to the surface that folks have maybe been ignoring, that folks didn't actually know exist, and it creates learning opportunities in the organization. But there's a big, big, big psychological trust and safety component too. If someone doesn't feel comfortable stating, hey, how does this work, right? The facilitator has to be confident in that. I usually recommend that person being an engineer, someone that is well-respected in the organization and can have these conversations with folks without fear. And also the folks on the other end, that's why it's important to do these in one-on-one meetings too, so that if they say something they feel is silly or they're describing a system in a way that it actually doesn't work like that, they have the freedom and comfortability to do that, because it's not reflecting on them. It's reflecting on the system and the organization as a whole, on how they're disseminating information to folks. Because ultimately, if they're working under different assumptions, you're going to be having a weird system overall, but you need to figure out what's making those oddities happen.
I like that picture of surfacing gaps in people's mental models. That's an interesting answer. The canonical answer is actually read the book, but that was an interesting answer.
Yes, I put a large set of questions in the book to help you become a facilitator.
Let's remind all listeners to, if you want those access to those questions and much more, get the Chaos Engineering book.
You'll never believe question 7. It's wild.
I believe we have some questions on the line.
Hi, Nora. Question for you. Yeah, so what is it we can learn from chaos engineering that we can't already learn from a well-executed root cause analysis?
Yeah, I think they're two very different things. A well-executed root cause analysis, I don't know exactly what that looks like. I would say that there are well-executed post-incident learnings that you can do, but they're two separate things. Chaos engineering is proactively looking at things, and I think they're inextricably linked. I like to think of them as sort of a feedback loop. You kind of can't do one without the other. You need to be able to learn from your incidents, right? And so you can do different chaos experiments. You can do better chaos experiments. You can know where to experiment, who to bring into the room, if you should fix it or not. Those kinds of things can't be totally learned without learning from your incidents first. But I wouldn't call that a well-executed root cause analysis, but that's not for today.
Maybe we should just execute our root cause analysis better.
Yeah, maybe.
Any other callers on the line?
Hi, long-time caller, first-time listener. My question is, what's the best way to adapt a postmortem template for use with chaos experiments?
Yeah, I there's a few different ways I would suggest that answer. I think you can look at a post-incident template and also look for opportunities to do chaos experiments in the future. Like, look at what surprised us during the incident. Look at who we needed to rely upon that we weren't sure we needed to rely upon, what parts of the system we needed to rely upon. And you can use that to feed into future chaos experiments. But you can also use some guides with chaos experiments too. Like, what are our expectations with this experiment? What are our hypotheses? Who do we need to tell about this experiment? When should we run it? Why does it matter when we run it? I think the two, I would call them guides rather than templates, so that folks don't feel like they have to stick to them. But I think, again, those two worlds are fairly linked, and they can be used as a feedback cycle into others. I would recommend mentioning chaos experiments in post-incident guides, and I would recommend mentioning incidents in chaos experiment guides as well, because that will help you see over time how you're actually doing, which chaos experiments you've run, which incidents have been associated with them, what the impacts of those incidents were.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Nora. Best of luck to you at Jelly. And I hope people read your book so that they don't mislearn the things that they should have learned because they didn't learn how to learn from incidents.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. head over to gotopia.tech for lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.